coffee-producing countries like Costa Rica are looking to distinguish themselves.
We're never going to be able to compete with countries like Brazil or Colombia or Mexico because they're far bigger.
So how about a coffee that fights climate change? I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, confronting global warming in the larger marketplace and in our jobs and livelihoods.
I've devoted my life to education, and now I think that climate change is the biggest issue facing us as a species.
Plus, you don't need fake blood or ghoulish plastic decorations to make Halloween scary. Nature is frightening enough. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. You've probably seen signs and labels for fair trade coffee. Maybe you buy it. Fair trade is an effort to make sure farmers and pickers are paid well. Well, coffee lovers might be seeing a new label on their one-pound bags: low carbon coffee. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips went to Costa Rica to learn how the country is pioneering efforts to produce coffee that tackles climate change.
What makes a good cup of coffee?
Seria, flavor? Sweet, clean.
I spent time with an expert in the tasting room at the Santa Anita coffee plantation in Costa Rica's West Valley to try to find out. In the world of high-end coffee, Erasmo Arrieta Soto is known as a cupper. Here's how he judges a good cup of coffee. The first thing Soto does to gauge quality is put the milled green coffee beans, which are actually seeds, into a small roaster and shakes them to make sure they don't burn.
Okay. Smells good.
7 minutes later.
Oh, it's puppy.
It's puppy.
It actually sounds like popcorn. Soto grinds it, pours hot water over the grounds in the cup, and slurps.
Very good is this coffee.
But in Costa Rica, good coffee is not just about taste. The Santa Anita coffee plantation is one of just a few places experimenting with what they call low-carbon coffee.
The idea of being climate-friendly, climate-neutral, low-emissions coffee, low-emissions meat. We're seeing this as a niche product.
Pascal Giraud is a senior advisor to Costa Rica's Minister of Environment and Energy. Costa Rica wants to go beyond good taste and be the leading nation for producing climate-friendly products, starting with coffee.
Because we're never going to be able to compete with countries like Brazil or Colombia or Mexico because they're far bigger. And they can produce at a lower cost.
The low-carbon coffee that Costa Rica is pushing is part of an overall plan by the country to become the first carbon-neutral nation and serve as an example to the rest of the world for how to tackle climate change. It's a small country with big climate ambitions. Maria Paz Lobo works for eCafe, or the Coffee Institute of Costa Rica, a government agency. She shows me around Santa Anita's 250-acre low-carbon coffee farm. Lobo is in charge of figuring out what kind of coffee the millennial population in the U.S. will want to buy.
So it's really important for us to start projecting what this population wants. And
she says Costa Rica is banking on them as a future market for high-quality, environmentally friendly, low-carbon coffee. She says millennials care a lot about the social and environmental impacts of whatever they consume. So what makes it low-carbon? In this case, a large solar array helps power the mill. And they're working to reduce fertilizers, because man-made fertilizers come from fossil fuels. It's the rainy season in Costa Rica. During an afternoon shower, Maria Paz Lobo says the weather has become unpredictable, downpours and droughts. Given the changing climate, she knows how important it is to try to save the country's coffee farms, because in Costa Rica, a good cup of coffee also means a good living for farmers.
But what we are hoping for is that the low carbon initiatives will make our differential price higher, so we can charge a little bit more for that coffee with low carbon.
But is there a market for low carbon coffee? And are coffee lovers in the U.S. willing to pay extra for it?
Costa Rica produces some phenomenal coffees.
Rick Reinhardt is the executive director of the Specialty Coffee Association. He says before anyone is going to pay more for low carbon coffee, it has to taste really good. So Costa Rica may be the best place to try it.
Costa Rica as a country has been very focused on environmental sustainability, and I think Costa Rica is a natural place to experiment with these values and with how they might be successfully brought to market.
Right now, there's an oversupply of specialty coffee like fair trade, and Reinhardt says low-carbon coffee is not a slam-dunk selling point. So what do coffee fanatics think?
Vietnamese iced coffee?
At Brown Street Coffee in Philadelphia, customers line up for cups of coffee sourced from places like Ethiopia and Costa Rica. Eric Cha owns the shop. Does he think Costa Rica is making the right choice, banking on a higher-end, low-carbon niche market?
Yeah, it's definitely a gamble. I think that they're too focused on the next new thing.
It's not cheap making low-carbon coffee, and Costa Rican producers work with higher prices to begin with. Those who are investing in efforts to reduce carbon emissions, like the owners of the Santa Anita farm, see it as an investment for the future coffee market. But Cha says he's not so sure his customers would pay extra.
As a business trying to pass that cost on to the consumer, I think it should be very tough.
Costa Rica's low-carbon coffee producers say they've been selling their beans in the U.S., Canada, Germany, and Japan. But so far, the producers haven't gotten coffee drinkers to pay a higher price for a cup that tastes good and is good for the climate. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Countries and cities are working on ways to reduce their carbon emissions, to be climate leaders. They're luminaries in the fight against global warming. Angela Merkel, an activist like Bill McKibben. And then there's the rest of us.
Hi, I'm Lisa Minetti, and I am... What do I say about myself? I don't know.
Lisa Minetti has been a teacher and a designer of online education programs for universities, but she recently retired.
I am on a sabbatical of sorts, thinking about what I'd like to do next in my life.
We're on a porch in Minetti's backyard, looking out onto her raised beds of kale. And she's telling me about applying to the Climate Reality Leadership Corps training in Pittsburgh.
And I was very excited that they accepted me. You know, I did some activism as a young person in my 20s, but that was so long ago, I didn't think it was at all relevant.
Minetti bought a house in the 90s, and when there was talk that a nearby former industrial site might once again become a working coke plant, she joined the movement to stop it, and they did.
I remember that feeling, like, we won, isn't this great? But then I also realized at that time when I was young, I was like, oh my gosh, this really consumes you. So I was like, I'm going to stay away from these activists because they're like, they're a little bit crazy, you know?
And she got on with her life. Eventually, she moved to Philadelphia, then New York to work at Columbia. And when she came back to Pittsburgh last year, she realized she might actually be one of those crazies. And fighting climate change might be her next chapter.
I know that the climate is changing and that humans are causing this change. And I know that some of the major reasons for the change are the carbon emissions, the methane emissions. And I know that as more carbon goes into the atmosphere, it gets worse and worse. I mean, you see, like when I try to explain what I know, like I have very primitive language. I don't know statistics. I'm not able to explain concisely where we are today, what we know, and what the major strategies are for solving this issue.
That's why she signed up for 3 days of the Climate Reality Project's leadership training with about 1,300 other people, looking to convince their friends and neighbors, whoever they can get to listen, that climate change is real and that moving away from fossil fuels is the way to stop it. Fossil fuels were already on Minetti's radar. She couldn't believe the extent that fracking for natural gas had taken hold in the region. And the tightness in her chest proved to her that Pittsburgh's industrial past wasn't really in the past.
I didn't have asthma for 15 years when I lived in Philly and New York. But when I came back to Pittsburgh, I had asthma again. Asthma!
Minetti was even more perplexed that otherwise friendly Pittsburghers were kind of defensive about the dirty air. And it made her wonder, who was going to listen to her?
I talked to my family and friends about it, and they all have heard it. Believe me, they've heard it. And my family is quite annoyed by it, right? Even when people you love are harmed by and talking about something, if you're kind of not dealing with it, I'm not a psychologist, but I want to know, like, if you can't even influence your own family through your personal experience or your closest friends who are around, how on earth, you know, are you going to influence? And I don't really have any idea what the answers are, because I don't know as an individual how you can influence. And that, I think, it does touch on kind of the crux of the issue with climate change. It's, Al Gore was right. It is an inconvenient truth. People don't want to see it. They don't want people to tell them what to do.
So she went to the training to find out more about climate change.
I am climate reality.
And I am climate reality.
I am climate reality.
Minetti saw Climate Reality Project founder Al Gore.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And his famous climate change slideshow that launched a movement.
It thrills me to be able to show it to you, because this is one of the few groups that I feel comfortable giving the 2-hour version to.
And then a more manageable 10-minute version trainees could learn to give.
Solar energy comes to the Earth every hour in quantities that are sufficient to power the entire global economy for an entire year.
She heard from esteemed scientists like marine biologist Nancy Knowlton.
A point was made about Arby's having more jobs than coal miners. It's a relevant point on one level, but those coal miners are real people. And so the comment that was made about respect, I think, is really important. Yeah. If we're going to solve this problem, we need to have everyone pulling in the
Absolutely.
Same direction. And we really need to minimize the number of enemies that we have.
And got advice from Olena Alec, Director of Climate Reality Leader Engagement.
Leverage your own skill set, leverage your own interests in order to begin to take further action.
Use your voice and your vote and your choices to fight, to speak truth to power like your world depends upon it, because your world does depend upon it. Thank you very much.
He was brilliant. He was exemplary as a speaker, and he gave so much valuable information that I actually felt extremely energized by that.
I visited Minetti again at her home after the training. Those are her parakeets flying around in the background.
One is blue with like a little bit of white on his face, and the other one is all yellow.
Is there something about the climate science that caught your attention, something you didn't know, or something you were just like, this is something I have got to tell people about?
So I didn't know, for example, that most of the heat released into the atmosphere was then absorbed by the oceans, 93% of it. And I thought, well, what does that mean, really? Who cares if the oceans are getting warmer? Well, because the oceans are getting warmer, we see, you know, massive shifts in our weather patterns to see that these events are happening all over the world. And now we have storms that are called rain bombs, and they're just like these big circular cloud formations that dump many inches of water in areas that are not accustomed to receiving this much. And so that's why we have so much flooding in places where people don't have flood insurance and where we hadn't previously expected it.
Minetti made a lot of connections, which she talks about passionately, although she says some of that is just how she speaks. She learned about a predicted drop in the amount of corn and wheat that could be grown because of global warming. And it reinforced a decision to work on getting people to eat less meat to reduce greenhouse gases.
We're making the Buddhist chef's homemade seitan.
Minetti tries out a recipe for a new plant-based dish as we talk. She's thinking fewer lectures, more experiences to change people's minds. She's going to an upcoming Allegheny County Health Department meeting to demand better pollution controls at the Clairton Coke Works across the river. And she and her husband are starting a blog.
We think we're going to call it Two Canaries, because that's what we feel like here, and we love birds.
Canaries in a coal region. Minetti says they'll give people form letters or postcards they can use to influence policymakers.
I'm thinking about what I want to do with the second half of my life. And it's a classic midlife reflection where I think, well, I've devoted my life to education and ensuring that people had the knowledge, skills, and tools that they needed to succeed. And now I think that really climate change is the biggest issue facing us as a species.
There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. If you take this nature hike at night, you never know who you might run into.
I know what you guys are. Do you know what I am?
It's hard to see in the dark. Need a hint?
I mean, they found bones of me with the dinosaurs.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, we take a nature walk after dark with a night owl? I don't know. Stay tuned to find out. Since the news broke about the allegations of sexual harassment and assault against the movie executive Harvey Weinstein, the issue has been everywhere, on Facebook feeds, morning news shows, and blogs. More high-profile men in entertainment and other fields have been accused, mostly by women. And scrutiny has increased in the cases we already knew about, like Bill O'Reilly at Fox News. Well, a piece was recently published in Science magazine about a sexual harassment case against a prominent geologist. Elizabeth Collada is deputy news editor at Science, and she joins me now to talk about it. The article details the case of two women who were bringing a sexual harassment case against a former professor, David Marchant, for actions they say he took while they were doing field work with him in Antarctica. So briefly, can you just say what they're alleging?
Yes, they are alleging that while they were in small groups doing fieldwork in Antarctica, he sexually harassed them in really a very disturbing way. He didn't hit on them, at least that's not what they're alleging. They allege that he singled them out because they were women for other kinds of abuse. He physically shoved them. One woman, whenever she tried to go to the bathroom in the field, you know, go pee in the field, he threw rocks at her. He pushed her down slopes. He swore at them, called them terrible names. They say that he singled them out and harassed them severely. And I also want to say, like, the backdrop for this is that this is Antarctica, okay? So you are really remote. In the main complaint, the woman, her name is Jane Willenbring, and she's now at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. She says that they were in these small field groups, and sometimes they would only have contact with the main base by radio. So it was she and three men, and she really had no recourse. They were alone in the field.
It's really shocking to read her account, and it's kind of scary.
Yes. We received this account at first with documents. So I received these documents and I opened them and started reading them and my jaw dropped. I just couldn't believe some of the things that these women were alleging. The other thing that struck me when I read it, it happened 20 years ago. That's a long time ago. And yet these women are bringing this now. It's kind of amazing that this story broke. We published this story the day after the Harvey Weinstein stories was published. And that's just an accident, right? We were going along reporting this story and published it on the days that, it was appropriate for us to publish it. And Harvey Weinstein happened to be published the day before. And so that obviously relates to accusations of sexual harassment against Harvey Weinstein that also happened decades ago. So this issue of things happening a long time ago, but women are bringing them up now, is happening.
Why are the women and witnesses moving forward with a case now?
So the chief complainant, Jane Willenbring, says that she feared retribution from Professor David Marchant, who was at Boston University, and did not dare to make this complaint until after she was established as a scholar. So she received tenure from Scripps Institution of Oceanography last summer. Last October, she filed this complaint. It's what they call a Title IX complaint with Boston University. So she said she felt like if she had complained, he would have savaged her career. That's what she alleges. And so she waited. And the other complainant did not come forward until after this first one did. So there's sort of this effect of, you know, once one person starts, then another person apparently feels emboldened to come forward.
And what is Marchant saying?
So Marchant, we contacted him repeatedly. And I want to say, by the way, that I was the editor on this story. I had an absolutely wonderful reporter named Meredith Wadman, a terrific and experienced journalist who wrote this story. So Meredith contacted David Marchant repeatedly, and he really did not want to comment in any way. He said that the Boston University investigation is ongoing, that he is cooperating with that investigation, and that he would not comment until the investigation was finished. We do have other documents in the case that suggest that he denies these allegations.
Yeah, we should say that your piece mentions other female colleagues and students have stood up for him, saying, you know, they've never witnessed this kind of behavior from him.
Absolutely. We found a number of women who defended him. Women who more recently say that he is kind and genuine and defend his conduct and say that he has been a helpful mentor to them.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, there's sort of this phenomenon now. Harvey Weinstein was accused of sexual assault and harassment, and a lot of women are coming out and telling their stories. Let's zoom out a little bit. How common is this within the scientific community?
In science, you know, what we say is that if a senior professor sexually harasses a junior student, it's not necessarily news because unfortunately it is fairly common. You know, it is not rare. However, what is changing right now is that everybody's speaking about it. In science, there have been a number of high-profile cases. There was a case of an astronomer, his name was Geoff Marcy, who was an alleged repeated sexual harasser, and he was sort of railroaded out of astronomy. He resigned his position. 2 years ago, we did a story about an anthropologist named Brian Richmond, who had to resign from the American Museum of Natural History after a high-profile case. So more and more, there are these high-profile cases in science. They seem to be coming up in many fields of life, and science has it too.
The second complainant in the case against Marchant, Deborah Doe, that's not a real name, actually dropped out of academia. From what you've seen and reported about, does sexual harassment routinely keep women from pursuing research science or advancing in that field?
From what I've read, people seem to feel that sexual harassment is certainly one of the factors that can keep women out of science. And as you said, in this particular case, the second complainant, Deborah Doe, left science. She said that David Marchant would block her access to research funding, and so she felt her career dreams had gone down the drain. So here was an actual case of it, right? An actual example of it.
So how are these allegations against Marchant, you know, changing the conversation about sexual harassment? What kind of impact could this have?
It illuminates something people in the sciences are talking about a lot, which is what can happen in the field. Fieldwork is super important for many sciences. Like for environmental sciences, you want to be in the field because that's how you get the data. And so to have fieldwork be a time of crisis or fright is just a terrible thing for women. And so I think that this case is one of several both cases and also studies that is fostering conversation about how to make field work wonderful for everybody, women, men, junior, senior people, everybody.
Well, we will continue to follow these kinds of stories in science. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Kara.
Elizabeth Collada is deputy news editor at Science. There's a link to the article entitled A Cold Case at our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. The spookiest sounds of the Halloween season are made by wildlife at night. That's a red fox. Its scream is so disturbingly human that upon hearing it, people have called the police, thinking it was the cry of someone in need. Young barn owls save their screams for right around this time of year. They're looking for a mate. The English naturalist Gilbert White wrote in the 1780s that the barn owl's cries had whole villages imagining the churchyard to be full of goblins and specters. Well, when you're out trick-or-treating, you might hear a barn owl or two, or you could meet one and other nocturnal wildlife during a special nighttime tour. Producer Andy Cubis and her family were brave and joined in.
My name is Rachel Handel. I'm the Communications Director at Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania.
All right, Mary is your firefly, and you can follow Mary.
We have an event tonight, which is a really fun event called Creatures of the Night.
It's kind of spooky out here at night.
We have miles of trails that people can walk on, and they are led by firefly actors who guide them through the trails where they will meet the actors who are talking about what nocturnal creatures do here at Beechwood.
Owl. Look, I think I see an owl.
You hear that out there?
Just waking up. I had a busy night last night. I was catching a lot of mice and things. An owl has no teeth. They eat the whole moth, bones and all. And then about 12 hours later, they regurgitate. You know what regurgitate means? Oh, wait a minute. This is an owl pellet. Come up close. You want to touch it? See, this is the jawbone.
That's the jaw right there.
I think a lot of people are familiar with owls, but there are also flying squirrels, bats.
What's your favorite creature of the night?
A bat. Watch for bats.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. Look at that.
It's a bat.
Who is that? Come here, a little closer. I can't see very well, but I can really hear well because of my great big
ears,
yes. I can actually hear all the insects I like to eat. Oh, yummy. I hate to brag, but I'm also very agile. So using my echolocation, even in the darkness, I can dodge trees and fence posts and buildings. I'm a mammal, and I fly. I'm the only flying mammal in the sky. I eat mosquitoes, moths, and gnats. Oh, such tasty treats for bats. I'm a mammal, and I fly. Thank you.
Audubon's mission is to connect people to birds and nature through our programs, projects, and places. And the people who we love to see out are kids. And so, you know, at our events, we really encourage people to see the fun side of being outside. And this is a great way to do it.
I see it. It's right there, right behind that little thing.
Well, it's nice to see this many people in the woods at night. I know what you guys are. Do you know what I am?
Leopard.
No, I'm a possum. And I'm one of the few things out at night that's been around almost forever. I mean, they found bones of me with the dinosaurs. I can eat almost anything because he's like the junk man of the forest.
This is an oddly warm October night, and so we are hearing some insects outside that we definitely would not normally hear in October, and I think that's a little bit of a treat, too. It kind of makes it more fun and a little more spooky at the same time.
My work here is done. We have cider in here. We have a screech owl in here. And thank you for coming tonight. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you.
That was Mary Iman as the firefly, Ken Miller as the possum, Paul Schmidt as the owl, and Karen Beacon as the brown bat. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org, if you dare. Andy Cubis produced this audio postcard.
Are you a real reporter or is it just a costume?
Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Check out our podcast, Trump on Earth, at trumponearth.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.